Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find the new season of Here Be Monsters on August 17th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
It was a relatively substantive week in the campaign as both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton laid out economic agendas. Of course, Trump also derailed two news cycles with outrageous remarks. Meanwhile, the Baltimore police were subject of a scathing report from the Department of Justice, a report that pointed out racial inequities and also gender ones. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Josh Barrow, senior editor at Business Insider. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Gene Sperling, who served as director of the National Economic Council under Presidents Clinton and Obama, and who has also been advising Hillary Clinton. Our special guest is Kelly Goff, columnist for the Daily Beast and host of the WNYC series Political Party with Kelly Goff. Welcome to you all. Both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton thought Michigan would be the best backdrop for speeches they gave this week laying out their economic agendas and visions. Trump talked about the economic and industrial decline of Detroit. Clinton, meanwhile, talked about economic revitalization and said Trump is, quote, missing so much about what makes Michigan great. Trump hit a lot of his usual messages about trade and immigration and the need to put America first, but I thought there were two news items in the speech in terms of policies we hadn't heard before. Trump revised his tax plan, so the tax cut he's proposing is not quite so big. He'd lower the top tax rate from the current approximately 40 to 33%. Back last fall during the primaries, he'd said he would cut it all the way to 25%. Trump also said he would offer a tax deduction for childcare expenses, although the full details of that proposal are not yet available. Rich, what did you make of this speech? Did you, as a conservative, find this to be a compelling economic message?
Well, in a lot of ways, an utterly conventional Republican economic speech. Let's drill, baby, drill. Let's deregulate. Let's cut taxes. I thought two things that were welcome about it. It represented an end to 47% politics. You know, Mitt Romney's famous line about how people who don't pay income taxes are basically takers who are leeches on the American polity. And Trump was bragging about actually taking more people off the income rolls. And two, it represented an end to the debt obsession of the Republican Party. There's a period where you couldn't really talk to any House member, Republican House member, without him talking about the debt. That was the beginning and the end of the Republican agenda. Now, Trump obviously swings much more in the other direction. He has zero interest in paying for any of this. And I think politically, it would have made a lot more sense for him, given that he's a populist, to do something different. Maybe don't cut the top rate. Maybe do some big payroll tax cut. So now he opens himself up to all the usual attacks on Republican tax policy, policy that I may support, but doesn't play very well politically. And Hillary is already attacking him as a dangerous demagogue who, in addition to that, wants to cut taxes for the rich.
Gene, it's interesting what Rich says there, because you had this amusing short video at the Democratic Convention. I didn't realize you were going to be up on the screen. And one of the key messages in your video was about how Donald Trump would run up unsustainable amounts of debt. It seems like a departure, right, with a Democrat putting out the more small-c conservative message on borrowing than the Republican.
Well, I think that, you know, you can make very good arguments that, you know, when you're trying to get more demand, you know, that you could front load infrastructure. And, you know, I think we should be more concerned about tight labor markets and strengthening wages and jobs right now than we are about, you know, just the green eye shade of deficit and debt reduction. On the other hand, you know, Trump's kind of went off the deep end. You know, the Tax Policy Center found over 20 years his plan would increase the debt by $34 trillion. I mean, nobody has ever seen or heard of numbers like that. But I think Rich is right that the debate, that's what's most maybe disappointing to some reformist Republicans, and I do think leaves him vulnerable, is that he seemed to promise he might do something different. Remember, he even started by saying, hey, if you're a hedge fund and manager and you're getting carried interest, I'm going to get tough on you. Well, they would get 23.8% right now. Under his plan, they would pay 15%. And I think that's one of the greatest vulnerabilities of his plan, was that while, Josh, you said that he lowers his top rate, that he keeps his top rate more at 33% than 25%. For anyone who can find a way to show that they have any partnership interest or consulting income, so anyone, a corporate law partner, a partnership in a hedge fund, investment bank, most of the most well-off Americans would actually be paying a 15% rate by design, meaning they would be paying dramatically lower than the 39.6% they pay now. And they would be paying much lower marginally than millions of middle-income families. And then on multinational companies, where most Americans are concerned they don't pay their share, he would put them at 15%. So I think his vulnerability is not just how reckless the plan is debt-wise, but why he's doing it. He is running up trillions of dollars of debt to have a 15% rate for the most well-off people in the United States and for the most well-off companies who have often been successful in finding tax havens and other measures to pay what most people think is far too little.
Yeah, just to step back and explain that, because it's a technical matter, but it actually would be really important in terms of the budget. Currently, you know, you report wages and salaries on your taxes, and a lot of people also have self-employment income, or they own a business that's structured in a form where the business doesn't pay taxes directly. It just passes the income through to the owner, who then pays taxes on their personal return. And the way the current law works is the rate is the same. Whether your income is a salary or your income is profits from a small business you own, you pay tax at the same rate. Donald Trump would change that, and it would actually be a drastic change. As Gene describes, you'd pay at 33 on your wage or salary income. You'd only pay at 15 on your business income. And so there are two effects from that. One is that business income just tends to be earned from people with by people with higher incomes, because business owners on average are wealthier. But the other thing is that, as you described, there's a lot of flexibility about whether you're going to call your income wage income or business income. You know, I work for Business Insider. They pay me a salary, but I could instead sell them freelance articles. And if Donald Trump's tax plan came into effect, my tax rate would be drastically different for one of those kinds of structures than the other. And so people who could pick the structure with the lower rate would. The government would lose revenue, and then the people who would most be able to take advantage of that would tend to be wealthier.
Of the 400 richest Americans who make the most every year that the IRS determines, well over half right now would get income where they would get cut to 15%. You can imagine that the other 40% will not have a hard time in figuring out how all of their income would be at this 15%, which would make Trump's tax cut on the most rich multimillionaires the most dramatic we've probably seen from any major Republican presidential candidate.
Kelly, what did you think?
I'm going to say two words: Walmart moms. There was a really interesting focus group conducted with Walmart moms, which are moms who shop at Walmart, as the title goes, and have sort of replaced soccer moms as the battleground swing vote group du jour.
The focus group actually conducted by Margie O'Meara, a frequent guest on this program.
So one of the things, you know, to that point, you know, Politico has this survey of insiders that they do, who are all grassroots activists from both parties, who reveal their thoughts on the last week's events. And one of the subheadline, I'm paraphrasing, was something like, the last 2 weeks have been so bad, including the last couple of days, that Hillary Clinton would have to be caught on camera strangling puppies while surrounded by ISIS cheerleaders to lose, because even the last week has been so bad. And that is funny. And I'm not paraphrasing by that much. It was pretty much what the subheadline said in Politico. But my point is that subheadline came out of this week of the economic talk. And so for me, the way I read that is that Donald Trump really missed an opportunity this week, because he focused so much on the supporters he already has, which is white males. He kind of missed the opportunity to really help talk to some of those Walmart moms who he wasn't connecting with. And the interesting thing about that focus group is a number of them are not sold on Hillary Clinton. They weren't leaning towards her. They're open to a third party possibility, because he didn't close the deal this week. why didn't he close the deal this week? Because while he's out there talking about all these tax breaks, all the news stories are breaking about the fact that he actually doesn't provide child care for his employees, any of his working mothers, even though he talked about Trump kids. That's only for high-paying patrons who want to bring children for vacations at his resorts. His daughter's company doesn't even provide paid maternity leave. She does personally to her 12 staff employees, Ivanka Trump does, but at the company that actually makes her clothes, they don't pay paid maternity leave. They don't pay for child care. So he really missed an opportunity to use this speech and this messaging to reach the voters he doesn't already have, and he didn't do it.
It's interesting because the one thing in this speech that was aimed at those Walmart moms was this one sentence about that he would let parents deduct the average cost of child care from their taxes.
And which still benefits higher paying.
Yeah. Right. And then the campaign has put out a number of statements sort of clarifying and expanding on that idea over the week, saying, well, you could take the deduction above the line, which means that you can take it on top of the standard deduction, so you wouldn't have to be so wealthy that you itemize deductions to take it. And so you can change this at the margins, but there are sort of two things that are clear from it. One is that they didn't really think in great detail about mm-hmm. it. They were just like, oh, we need a childcare thing. Let's right. slap something on. And then as you adjust this at the margins, it will change how generous it is and how tilted it is toward the wealthy. But anything that's structured as a tax deduction, the value of it rises the higher your tax rate
Absolutely.
Is. So it's, you know, any way you slice it, it's going to be something that's more valuable to parents with high incomes than to parents with low incomes.
And to me, the real missed opportunity there is it's not that he is only doing things to benefit the wealthy. I think it's that he's completely disconnected from people who aren't. To me, that was really the takeaway.
Let's talk some about Hillary Clinton's speech. Which was also in Michigan, as we noted. I sort of counted five main themes out of that speech. She talked about infrastructure spending, debt-free college, encouraging companies to do profit sharing, higher taxes on the wealthy, and then a suite of policies aimed at basically supporting family incomes, an expanded child tax credit, a higher minimum wage, paid family leave. And I guess my question to Gene about this speech is that when I look at this list of proposals and then a zillion small ones like making it easier for small businesses to file their taxes, I look at it and I think about a worker who just says, well, my wages aren't rising fast enough. And for low-income workers, a higher minimum wage would mean higher wages in their pockets. But for a middle-income person who earns $20 or $30 an hour, $40,000 or $60,000 a year, people who are already in the workforce have finished their education. What is there in this for them to look at and say, this is different from what's been going on for the last 8 years? This is a thing that's really going to raise my standard of living.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that while the minimum wage, raising it to, you know, $15, having a living wage is extremely important for tens of millions of Americans, it's not going to speak to many of the middle income families who feel that they're, you know, working harder and still falling behind a bit. And those are the long-term structural problems that I don't think Barack Obama had as much chance to deal with because he was inheriting a financial crisis. So I guess the way I would look at her plan as someone who advises her is that we're putting everything through a single lens. Is it increasing the jobs created in the United States and the good-paying jobs in the United States and the degree of economic security and dignity a working family has? And so things like infrastructure, the manufacturing initiative, these are about attracting jobs in the United States that are more likely to be high-paying. Front-loading the infrastructure is about tightening the labor market, putting more pressure for wages to go up, for employers to give some workers who may have been on the sidelines a chance to come back in. Those are the type of things that are better for wages, both because it's tighter labor demand and because you're trying to attract higher value added job creation and job creation that's more likely to be in the United States. And things like infrastructure, construction, manufacturing, innovation, it is about creating an attractive environment for those jobs to be here. And then the second part is, are you making sure that those typical families are having the security they want? And that's where I think she does speak more naturally, as perhaps Kelly was suggesting, on things like child care, paid family leave. When we put forward a tax credit for families, we don't have to think about it for 5 days to figure out how to make it more fair for those who need it. We do child credits and credits for health care and caregiving that are directed specifically to be more generous to the families who need it the most, not just the lower income families, but the middle income families who are struggling paycheck from paycheck.
Rich, what did you think about the speech?
It just seems more of the same, tweaked in a Bernie Sanders direction. And with a broad framework of optimism that I think is a little out of touch with the public and would be a vulnerability of hers in a different presidential campaign than the one that we're witnessing. But it is remarkable, just we've hit on this theme before in the program, just how our debate has shifted to the left, where you have both major parties are to some extent protectionist and in favor of big infrastructure programs. And in fact, it's the Republican candidate who's in favor of the bigger infrastructure program than Hillary Clinton. Trump says he'll at least double her infrastructure program. And I favor infrastructure, but I think it's a mistake to think of it as a jobs program. That's always a failure.
Well, let us know what you think about the candidates' economic agendas at kcrw.com/LRC, our Facebook page, or message our Twitter account. That's at LRCKCRW. Up ahead, Second Amendment people. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. Stay up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow of Business Insider and MSNBC. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Gene Sperling, who has advised Presidents Clinton and Obama and candidate Hillary Clinton on economic matters. Kelly Goff of The Daily Beast and WNYC is also with us. So I want to deal as quickly as possible with the two big Trump gaffes of the week, which were Trump saying maybe there was something, quote, Second Amendment people could do to stop Hillary Clinton from appointing justices with a narrow view of the Second Amendment. He later said he was talking about political action, not violence. And then also his repeated insistence that Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are the founders of ISIS, a statement he defended and defended and defended and defended, and then said he was just being sarcastic. Why didn't everybody understand that? In general, I'm finding it hard to engage with these stories because so many of them seem to be the same, but it felt like the Second Amendment people thing was over the line in a way that it exceeds even Trump's usual atrocious standard of discourse. Is there anything you guys need to get off your chest about what Trump said this week?
I think I'll defer to yet another Walmart mom. One of my favorite moments from the focus group was one of the Walmart moms said, maybe I'm misunderstanding or missing something, but it sounds to me like he's telling people to take her out. Now, I think if a Walmart mom who doesn't, you know, have a spin strategy with the campaign interprets it that way, that says that, sarcastic or not, the what he was trying to say landed in a way that sounded very inappropriate, offensive, and dangerous.
But I do think it was a joke. Now, it's obviously a joke that a presidential candidate never should say. And all I had to say afterwards is, look, I was kidding. It was a mistake. I won't do it again. And the whole thing ends. But instead, every time one of these things happen, the Trump campaign drags its defenders through this humiliating process of pretending he said something else. And then it drags out for 72 hours of debate over whether what did he really mean it or not. And I think one big takeaway for me from this week is Trump is losing, but he's enjoying himself. He likes entertaining these crowds. He likes playing to them and pumping them up, whether it's on message or not. And then he enjoys the media obsession afterwards. And there was a tweet he sent out Friday morning about the founder of ISIS thing after he said it was sarcastic, which also he could have said, you know, 3 days earlier, that I really love watching the pundits on TV. They can't figure out what I'm doing, and I love watching it. And he really does. So he enjoys these completely self-destructive media controversies.
He likes being the center of attention. But I would also say that actually, even the joking and the sarcasm, first of all, I think he needs a dictionary to find out what sarcastic actually means. That would be a good start. But the second part of that is it actually plays into one of Hillary Clinton's primary strengths and one of her best political ads to date, which is the one showing all of the national security conservatives saying, I really worry about his temperament. Because let's take him at his word, which I'm not sure I do, but let's take him at his word that he was really just joking. He was really being sarcastic. Is that who we want making sarcastic jokes for the next 4 years about people who want to bomb our country? I don't think we do. So, you know.
And Josh, I have a slightly darker interpretation. I mean, I think there really is a pattern. And I think even people like Paul Ryan have been disturbed by this pattern. And it is that when you get asked a question by David Duke, when you get asked things, you do a long wink. a long suggestion to the worst instincts in our country on, you know, racism or, you know, violence. And then after you've let it hang out for a while, there's this sense that you pull it back. But I think that if you look at what he does all the time, he is communicating, and he's communicating to people's worst instincts, not their best instincts. And, you know, I've been in a lot of campaigns, and you always feel, you know, a lot of, you know, tense, and you're competitive against your opponents. But I have never in, you know, 26, 28 years I've been involved in this, had this feeling that the our opponent was in such a predictable, coordinated way, trying to constantly wink to people's darkest instincts. And this, to me, was just like the David Duke comment. So, of course, he's going to pull it back, but not till he's communicated something very irresponsible and reckless.
For the record, there's a reason that he's pulling, that David Duke is pulling better with Black Americans than Donald Trump.
Is that true?
That's absolutely true. I have a column coming out about that.
I want to get to one more topic before we finish today, which is a report from the Department of Justice that had many negative things to say about the practices of the Baltimore Police Department, which has been in the news over the last year and a half following the fatal injury of Freddie Gray while in police custody. The report has many stories of due process violations and racial inequities. In one case, while a DOJ investigator was riding along with Baltimore police, a supervisor instructed a patrol officer to stop and question a group of young Black men. The officer protested that he had no cause to do so, and the supervisor responded, "Make something up." But another section of the report that hasn't gotten as much attention deals with the Baltimore PD's treatment of sex crimes, saying the department does not adequately investigate reports of sexual assault and does not take women reporting sexual assault seriously. Kelly, what did you make of this?
Well, I'm so glad to actually see this report finally come to light, because I just wrote about for the Daily Beast a couple weeks ago, specifically the issue of how we focus so much on racial bias among the NYPD, among police officers in general, and we don't focus nearly enough on bias, gender bias. And specifically, one of the things I focused on in my column is while the data shows that Black Americans in particular certainly have proof and reason to fear police and feel like they're being targeted, particularly when it comes to things like stop and frisk and being pulled over. What doesn't get nearly enough attention is that while domestic violence plagues about 10% of American families, it plagues about 40% of families who have a law enforcement officer in them, which is pretty scary and significant. And one of the things that I mentioned in my piece is the fact that those women, in the same way that we talk about Black Americans not feeling their voices heard when they try to report incidents, women who are married to officers or cohabitate with them really are terrified of often reporting these incidents because they're often handled, quote, informally or in-house, as in we'll send them to counseling and not really address the issue seriously. And for years, prostitutes and women who are sex workers have claimed that they are taken advantage of by law enforcement. So to see a report that actually does show that this issue is serious enough that the Justice Department is trying to change things, and to hear law enforcement leaders in Baltimore and other places saying that they're going to officially address it, particularly where gender bias and racial bias collide, right, where you have poor women of color, such as what we saw in Oklahoma with Daniel Holtzclaw, who had been targeting poor Black women for years and was finally just caught this year. I'm glad to see this issue getting the attention it deserves.
One thing I thought about reading the report is, I mean, obviously policing is a function of local government, and that's where the first level of accountability is. And I'm trying to figure out, you know, what a national policy, what a role for the federal government is, and because obviously so many local governments are falling down terribly on the job here, but it's not something a president can just come in and directly fix. So I guess the question is, what is the role in our national political discussion about this? What do national politicians need to be doing to create an environment where local police do better at this stuff?
Well, I'm not sure what they can do besides jawboning. And this is something where I think both President Obama and Donald Trump pretend that they're national sheriffs, and they're not. This is a local function. And I haven't read the report, and I totally accept the idea that Baltimore police is poorly run and can be improved in many ways. But my understanding from the coverage that a lot of these disparities are against the benchmark of population, which is really not the way to get a clean look at what's going on. It has to be against criminal offending. And The Department of Justice seems to want to really make this about proactive or zero tolerance policing, which the left is making into a boogeyman. But it's not a bad thing if someone's urinating on your stoop, if someone's running an open air drug market in your neighborhood, or someone's trespassing in your housing project. You need police affirmatively to be stopping those things from happening.
But
because at the margins, you may be reducing more serious criminal activities, but you certainly are making those neighborhoods more livable.
But we also do need police investigating things like rape. And what this report showed is that they're not, particularly if the people, if the alleged, the women who have been victimized are poor. And that tends to overwhelmingly affect women of color. And actually, I have to be honest, one of the reasons that all of these stop and frisk policies drive me so insane is you have police stopping people who haven't done anything, like some of my friends who are walking down the street in a suit and tie on their way to their job. And I think to myself, has every rapist been caught yet that actually you do need to be investigating? And what this report showed is that 15%, only 15% of rape kits had even been tested in Baltimore, like tested. So I think to answer the larger question, no one likes hearing responses like this because they're not interesting. They don't make for good cable news chat fest. But one of the most important things to do is to actually come up with nationalized standards for reporting on things. Because what we found is even when it comes to racial profiling, when you force local precincts to report things to the federal government, all of a sudden, conveniently, you start seeing behavior change and improve because people have to answer for it. So I think the same could be done in terms of rape kit processing, keeping data on, follow through with people reporting sex crimes and things like that.
Gene, did you have any quick thoughts before we go?
Well, I support what Kelly said, and I guess, you know, from the national level, I think what you need is our leaders to create an environment where people both honor the overwhelming majority of brave police officers who protect us but are willing to take on these type of unacceptable abuses. And the only thing I'd say is, you know, a lot of the headlines are, oh, it shows there's also gender discrimination. Well, let's be honest. This is discrimination against women who are poor and of color, and it's a window into how poorly they are being treated. And I think that has to go higher in our national discussion and awareness.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
A kid tried to climb Trump Tower with suction cups, which reminded me of one of my more dubious pet ideas. There's a bridge in West Virginia that is closed once a year so base jumpers can legally jump off of it. I believe New York City should close a skyscraper once a year so adventurers of all sorts can climb and jump off it as they see fit. If West Virginia can do it, so can the greatest city in the world.
Kelly Goff?
My rant for this week is that Ivanka Trump is a very talented businesswoman who also seems to have her heart in the right place on the right issues when it comes to helping women who are not as privileged as her achieve work-life balance. I'd like to actually see her, though, walk the walk in terms of her father's presidential campaign, in terms of policies, because it's great to give a fabulous speech about what he should be doing, what you think he should be doing, but not when your company making your clothes, and certainly not his companies, are actually doing the same thing.
Gene Sperling.
When I was 13, I had a radical thought. I wanted to have an all-chocolate bar mitzvah cake with chocolate ice cream. My Uncle Stu, who passed away last night at 82, he supported me on that, and he was a wonderful uncle and wonderful person. And my rant is the rant everybody goes through when they lose an older relative like that, which is you wish you'd called a little more often. You wish you hadn't waited. So I'm doing that rant at myself now, and I'll say it in the hope that maybe a few people listening will pick up the phone a little quicker to call their favorite uncle or aunt.
Thank you, Gene. I'm very sorry for your loss, and that's good advice for all of us. For my rant, I want to pick up on something Kelly mentioned a little bit earlier in the episode, which was Donald Trump talking about childcare at his businesses. He talked about how for employees, they have these programs like Trump Kids, where they can have their kids be cared for while they're at work, and that these programs are useful and not very expensive to set up. These are programs for paying hotel guests and golfers at Donald Trump's resort properties. They are not for his employees. The Associated Press looked into this, could not find any examples of on-site childcare offered by Trump companies to Trump employees. This is just another example of Donald Trump lying about anything and everything. It's why CNN has to do those cutesy chyrons with the parentheses around corrections of Donald Trump. He lies so fast the press can't keep up with it. Big things and small things. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Gene Sperling, and Kelly Goff. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Ashleen Knutson is our production assistant. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.